Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Caroline.
And I'm Anna.
And this is Seriously, the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman.
Hello.
Hello.
Welcome back to another episode of Seriously. We've been up to various things over the weekend. Caroline, you went to see some 20th century opera, I believe.
Yes, so with another New Statesman culture hat on, I was reviewing Berg's Wozzeck at the South Bank Centre, which I'm not going to bore anyone with the details of here. If you want to read about it, you can, you know, do that. The important point is that the part of the reason I wanted to review this is because a really handsome man was going to be singing in it. And then at the last minute, it turns out the handsome man was ill and couldn't do it.
So I had
to watch a less handsome man do it.
That's so annoying.
Which was really sad. But he sounded really nice, so it didn't matter.
That's a real shame. I spent the weekend in my hometown of Cheltenham in Gloucestershire. Shout out to Cheltenham. And it's the literature festival at Cheltenham at the moment, which is actually like surprisingly good. When I go home, I had this conversation with my mum where I was like, Mum, we were driving around. There's lots of posh people in Cheltenham, aren't there? And she was like, yes, Anna, well done, there are. And I was like, well, why, if you were posh and had like loads of money, why would you come to Cheltenham? And Mum was like, Anna, I know you've like grown up here, so maybe you don't see it, but like, this is actually a nice place. So like, don't be so mean about it. And while I was there for the festival, like, there was quite a lot going on. Mm. And I was really like, oh, you know what, actually, this is really quite cool. And it was quite like bustling. So that was really nice. And I went to see Ali Smith.
Yay, we love Ali Smith.
We love Ali Smith so much. And I got my book signed like a complete geek, which was really fun. And
did you talk to her?
Yeah, I did. I sort of said like, oh, you write for us at the New Statesman. And she was like, oh, Anna. And I was like, no, you don't know me. You didn't know me. But she was obviously really nice. And we chatted a bit about Cheltenham and a bit about the John Berger event we went to a few weeks ago now. And yeah, she was great. She spoke like really, really well. And she's really, when she speaks live, you can tell that she feels this burden upon her to like actually be spontaneous and not just like deliver the same lines about the book and about her process. And she even talked about that pressure a little bit. That was quite fun. She kept being like, so it's just like, you know, that lady over there said, it's like this, 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 or it's like that guy's anecdote about seeing a thumbprint in a statue. It's just like that. So she was quite good at like bringing everyone, you know, to feel like they were in the moment. So yeah, and the rest of the weekend I just sort of had a jolly with my various family members, and it was really nice.
Didn't you see Sandy Toksvig in a car park?
Oh yeah, I did see Sandy Toksvig in a car park. My mum went, is this my imagination or is that Sandy Toksvig? And then like Sandy Toksvig and whoever she was with, her partner maybe, I don't know, sort of like looked at us like, yep, hi, we can hear you. And then I was like, Mum, get out of the car park. I've got to get my train, get out of here. But yeah, no, it was really a nice idyllic weekend.
I've never been to Cheltenham, but I feel like seeing Sandy Toksvig in a car park is a very sort of Cheltenham celebrity spot.
I don't know, really. Like, we don't really have any Cheltenham celebrities. Shall I tell you something really tragic, listeners? This is like something that I wouldn't tell random people I know, so enjoy this one. The festival's been coming, you know, every year for as long as I can remember being there. When I was sort of 15, maybe even younger, actually, like 14, I was like obsessed with Russell Brand, and he was meant to be coming. And while I was at home this weekend, I had to go through loads of boxes of crap. My mum was like, can you really like sort some of this stuff out? And I found loads of my old diaries, and I found my old diary entry from the day that it was announced Russell Brand was cancelling his appearance at the Literature Festival. And it's just like a beige page, like painted intentionally like a fawn colour and then like a clipping of the newspaper article
saying he wasn't coming,
and that's it. And like all the entries beforehand have like little pictures of Russell Brand like being like spent so many days.
Oh my goodness, that's so sad. You painted it beige.
I know, so tragic. And like I am so embarrassed by that now, you know. I don't feel quite the same way about Russell Brand these days, just to clarify my position. Cheltenham full of surprises around every corner. No Russell Brand, but other surprises aplenty.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Moving on from that highly too involved look at my life, we're going to talk a bit about Macbeth this week, aren't we?
Yes, so the new film adaptation starring Michael Fassbender and Marion Cotillard, which is just out in cinemas now, I feel like. It was just this past weekend.
Yeah, it was on Friday.
It was on Friday it came out. I tweeted about this and actually got a few other people responding to me saying the same. I was really surprised how busy my showing of it was.
Mm.
For some reason, I just had in my head, you know, sort of like artsy film adaptation of Shakespeare, Sunday afternoon, South London, that's going to be an easy ticket, right?
Yeah.
But actually, there was barely any space left when I turned up. And the entire cinema was full of Scottish people, which was a bit unnerving.
The Scottish contingent of
South London. The Scottish contingent
of
South London was all in the Clapham Picture House. And it was really buzzy. Yes, I wasn't quite expecting that. But the film itself, I really liked it.
I too really liked it. Yeah. It's quite good that we don't have to sort of explain what it's about. It was Macbeth.
It was just Macbeth. And whilst they did make certain modifications and obviously cut loads of the text, because there's no way you could do a whole Shakespeare play in an under 2 hour film, it's broadly the same story as you'll know from school or other films or plays versions of it you've seen.
All hail Macbeth.
All hail. All hail Macbeth, it shall be king.
So foul and fair a day I have not seen.
Come, you spirits that tend on mortal thoughts. Hail king that shall be.
Duncan comes here tonight.
So I suppose that frees us up to talk more about the kind of aesthetic and the feel
style
of it. Something I really, really liked about it was the fact that they'd made it Scottish, properly Scottish again.
Yeah.
It was all set like right in the Highlands in places. I'm about to go on holiday to a place just like this.
Exciting.
I go every year, so I'm a sucker for this kind of thing. But yeah, it felt very, very kind of period of the period in which the real King Macbeth lived.
It was sort of pulsing with Celtic blood, wasn't it, the whole way through. It's really kind of like fiery and angry and like all the kind of things you would probably want from Macbeth, but with a sort of like, I mean, I don't want to be an idiot and be like gritty Scottishness, because obviously Scotland is not inherently gritty, but that was sort of the feel they were going for.
Yeah, and kind of primal and gory, and as you say, very Celtic.
It was very like literally visceral, like there was a lot of blood and like tears and spit and, you know, rain on people's faces and
sort of fog and smoke, and just, it didn't feel sanitised
no,
in any way.
I agree.
A point that the New Statesman film critic Ryan Gilby made in his review of it was that whilst the costumes and the design of it are really, really stunning, often with a kind of historical adaptation of something, you get great costumes, but they look too new and too fresh, whereas these things look like they've been like sweated in and lived in a way that yeah. they would have done for the period. And that was, I probably wouldn't have picked up on it if Ryan hadn't already pointed it out, but it just added to this overall sense that you weren't looking at something kind of sterile and produced, you were looking at something really lived in.
I was found myself frequently really entranced by all the fabric in it. I felt like yes. I was often looking at the fabric of their clothes. So it was very kind of like rough, like burlappy almost looking fabric, but very kind of like nicely handled and stuff. So it looked really, I mean, obviously it's so easy for me to sit here in 2015 and say, it looked so authentic. I have no idea, obviously. I don't know what people's clothes actually looked like in that time, but it felt, which is kind of even more important, it felt authentic.
And it also fed into how you perceive the characters. So like at the beginning, you know, when Macbeth isn't even the Thane of Cawdor yet, he's just wearing very plain like leather armor.
Mm-hmm.
He looks just like anyone else. And then when he becomes king, he's wearing, I mean, not even in his coronation, like just in his normal day-to-day life as the king, he's wearing this amazing woven like red and gold cloak thing with brooches holding it in place. And so yeah, as much as I was like you, completely dazzled by this fabric, it added to your sense of him kind of rising.
Exactly. And also I felt that there was a real move, the opening of the film, which I think we'll talk about a bit more in a minute. It's very funereal and everyone's in stark black, and then obviously you have the king's death and that's another funeral and everyone's still in these black clothes for the whole first bit when they're sort of camping. And as the film moves along, their outfits change quite a lot. So obviously you get the rise to power, you get the ceremony of Macbeth being crowned. Lady Macbeth's got, and all the other women have got blue eyeshadow and stuff. And then there's a real shift into Macbeth and Lady Macbeth are often in their night gear, often in white. And there's loads of them wearing white, which I thought was quite interesting because obviously in Macbeth you have all that imagery about looking like the innocent flower and being the serpent underneath it.
Yeah.
And sort of as they get more and more like encased in their own bad deeds, they start wearing white, which I thought was quite an interesting sort of subversion.
And then also kind of spoiled white, like
exactly.
Both of them go on a kind of walkabout wander across the heath at various times, him to go and sort of see the witches, her just because she's kind of losing her mind. The kind of staining from this kind of wandering shows up all the more on your kind of like long white nightie than it would if you're wearing something a lot more practical. And also I think it just shows up your state of mind that you can't even get dressed properly to go outdoors.
And you get sort of the unsex me here speech. She's surrounded by gold and in these very dark clothes, and then when she has her sort of speech where Lady Macbeth is kind of like unraveling, she's all dressed in white and you get a real sense of these big blue eyes and she seems suddenly so much more vulnerable. That's a really interesting
the use
well.
Of colour in the whole film is absolutely amazing. So as you say, the white and the blue and the gold is there all the way through, but also stone tones you get.
Yeah, and heavy blacks.
And heavy black. And then the bit that I thought was the kind of crowning achievement of the whole film, what's the famous line? When something wood comes to Dunsinane.
Burnham Wood.
When Burnham Wood comes to Dunsinane, which is part of the kind of witch's prophecy that Macbeth won't fall until this wood comes to this other place, and obviously that's impossible.
Yeah, and normally it's a very vaguely, I find, comedic. Obviously it's not meant to be, but like all the men come to war like covered in sticks and bits of wood.
Yeah, in order to fulfill the prophecy.
Yeah.
Whereas in this case, Macduff and Malcolm set fire to the wood, like they cause a massive forest fire. And it just feels that much more primal and elemental because obviously the wind is with them, like demonstrating the momentum is with them, and it's blowing all the sparks and the debris from this fire to the castle where Macbeth is. And you see him like come out and like feel it on his face, all these sparks
and
this red glow and the
everywhere.
Ash and the smoke. And that's when, and he smells it, and that's when he knows like the wood has come to me and I'm going to fall.
Yeah.
And that was, and then so the whole last battle scene happens in this kind of red fog, which is obviously massively metaphorical for all the blood being shed and the confusion and stuff. But that was such an amazing use of cinema as a medium, I thought.
I agree, because that's obviously something you just couldn't do on the stage.
No.
But it fits so well, because I remember reading G. Wilson Knight's Wheel of Fire, which is his criticism of the four main tragedies. And he talks a lot about how Macbeth is so important in terms of atmosphere and that weird kind of supernatural. Obviously, they've got all the lines about like the dogs eating each other and stuff like that. And for me to have the final battle really coming into that elemental supernatural feel, as you say, it just works so well. And that red as well, that was one of the things that struck me in the opening of the film. So the very first shot, I think, so they often have the landscape overlaid with red in a way that you can tell that is enhanced. Like they just put like a big red filter over it. And the beginning starts with that sort of coming up the screen. So that if you imagine the screen divided into black and red and the black's going up.
Yeah.
Or it might be the other way around, I can't remember. But it's like a curtain rising in the theatre, which I thought was really clever because it kind of gets you into that idea that, you know, this is actually a very, very theatrical but cinematic version of the theatrical.
Yeah, it was so much more successful to acknowledge that element than other Shakespeare film adaptations where they try for some sense of naturalism, which you just can't. I mean, that's not how the stories were written, so it just doesn't work. Let's talk about the main like plot change or addition, which is supposed to give Lady Macbeth and, well, I think principally her actually, a bit more of a motivation than just pure ambition for what they do, is this idea of loss and lost children. You mentioned the beginning of the film. I mean, all of it is completely visually stunning, but this particularly beautiful and so, so desperately sad funeral of their child who looks to be, what, like two?
Tiny.
Yeah, like really little. Mm. And so the child is like laid out on a funeral pyre.
It's really sad.
And they're kind of performing the kind of last rites, like laying stones over their eyes and stuff before they set fire to it. And they all stand there wrapped in these great big black robes, like watching the pyre burn. Which is obviously echoed later when other people die and the same funeral rites given to them. But you get the sense that just the way that the two central characters kind of cling to each other and the way they look at each other is like, that was it. That, like, the heart's gone out of them now.
Yeah.
That gives a context for everything that they do after that is, well, we've already lost everything we had to lose. So, and also Macbeth is then, in the early battle scenes, he's haunted by this kind of young man who you're never quite sure if he's real or not, or whether he was real, he gets killed and then he keeps appearing to him, whether it is his son or not his son or someone else's son. But he's haunted by this young man, and you get the sense that whether it's real or not, he's
very young as well, isn't he? He looks about 15, like, maybe,
or even younger. Like, this is the heir he thought he would have.
And there's definitely this completely renewed emphasis on children, and it doesn't really make you think of back to the original play and how much actually it is about inheritance and children. Well, I think for everyone, the saddest bit in Macbeth is when you realise that Macduff's wife and children have been murdered. Which they actually visually show this film.
Awful.
Often it's an offstage thing that you just hear about, so that you really hear about it with Macduff. But their decision to show it, I think, makes the scene relate back to Macbeth and Lady Macbeth's own child's death. Because, as you say, they've got this terrible funeral scene and the child is cremated. And so you see them light a kind of wood thing that the baby's on fire. And it feels so unnatural because you just see this tiny kid literally burning and it feels awful. And then later on, when they capture Macduff's wife and his children, they burn them alive.
They burn them at the stake.
At the stake. And it's so terrifying to watch. The way it made me feel was, it's like, it was so unnatural and so horrible that they suffered this loss, that it just perverted their own natural or maternal or paternal instincts and clouded everything for them. And I think there's a real sense of bitterness in this film about the fact that other people have children and other people have the possibility to pass their power down onto their children. And Macbeth and Lady Macbeth's ambition to grab onto power seems like weirdly perverted by their own loss in that sense.
Yeah, and actually that was, I thought, Marion Cotillard's finest moment in the film, when she's standing right in front of the stakes where these people are going to be burned, and she's looking right up at Macduff's wife and she's kind of weeping and, I think,
astonished
and kind of surprised where their own actions have led them. That was also a really brutal use of the cinematic gaze, I thought, because you get the pan rightwards across the landscape and you see all the people assembled to watch this, and then you see Macbeth and you keep thinking, they're going to stop, we're not actually going to see them on fire, but no,
but
you do. Because if the characters have to look at it, then you have to look at it, is the feeling.
And it's really playing on that idea of, like, yeah, natural death, unnatural death, murder, which is perhaps the most unnatural death. And it's also comes back to the idea of whether they can pass their power on, because that's one of the main things that the witch's prophecy says. It's that actually Banquo's heirs will inherit the throne.
And they really emphasise that, don't they, with the escape of his son.
Yeah.
And then you see him again right at the end, like, sort of take up sword and continue
the violence.
Yeah,
and he is, again, so young.
So young. He looks like he's about 10.
Yeah, so that's really... It really brings that all back home to you. And another way that they do that is in the famous scene between Macbeth and Lady Macbeth. It's not the milk of human kindness scene, but later, where they're arguing about whether they should continue with, you know, all these terrible things, the bit all about bad deeds. And he, in that scene, takes his knife and Macbeth is really poking it into Lady Macbeth's belly and sort of implying that the fact that they don't have an heir is her fault. Or it just comes back to this, you know, this loss, and it really is one of the most prominent themes in this version.
That, combined with the very deliberately Scottish setting, I think is what made it a success for me, because with any adaptation, whether it's stage or film or whatever, of Shakespeare, there's always this pressure to kind of do something with it. You can't just do the play. You have to find something new in it.
Yeah, which can be terribly gimmicky.
And I feel like I have no problem with that as an idea, because I think it's, you know, the kind of thirst for innovation and creativity is what keeps these plays going
alive.
Round and round, and that's great. But actually, I feel like, anyway, in the past few years, particularly with the kind of so-called, like, four great tragedies, of which Macbeth is one, a lot of the productions are quite samey, in the sense that they often go for a military setting, whether it's like Stalinist Russia or East Germany or Nazi Germany. Yeah, I've seen lots of Lears and Hamlets and Macbeths now that have that feeling. And I just think, this is boring, do something else with it, set it in space.
Yeah, well, I think one of the hardest things to do with a cinematic version of Shakespeare is keep it in its original setting and make it accessible, which they've done tremendously by just making it such an aesthetic visual triumph. All the noises, it's very textured, like you'll feel very much in it, and the colours, everything, it's just so really, really put together so consciously as an aesthetic whole thing, and that's what I really loved about it.
The only jarring bit, I think, is the accents.
Yeah, there are some bad accents.
There are some bad Scottish accents and some more Highlandy accents.
Yeah, but some really great performances as well. Yeah. I thought Malcolm was excellent. Really, really good.
As was Professor Lupin.
The starring role for Professor Lupin. I wanted to make an honourable mention as well to another Macbeth version, which I love and I think all our listeners should go and watch, which, although it might fall into the trap of being a bit gimmicky, as we were just talking about, is a 2005 BBC, it was called Shakespeare Retold, the series of Shakespeare adaptions they did for the TV, and they were all modern language, hence Shakespeare Retold, and this one was set in a kitchen, which sounds very low stakes, but they made it very high stakes, and it stars James McAvoy as Macbeth and Keely Hawes as Lady Macbeth.
Oh yes, I remember this.
There's an idea in it that someone's going to buy the kitchen and the head chef might be able to get partnerships, so there's lots and lots of money at stake, but it's very fresh and clean aesthetic, in complete contrast to the movie that we've just been talking about. But they managed to update it really, really well, and I haven't seen this, I was just looking it up, I haven't seen this since 2005 when it aired, and I can remember every scene in such detail because it was just, again, really visually striking. So there's a scene where James McAvoy goes to his big chef's kitchen and there's all these pints of milk in there, and he starts drinking the pint of milk and it's just blood all dripping down his face because he's like having hallucinations and stuff, and that's like terrifying and really brings that metaphor from the play home in your mind. There's a scene where Keely Hawes is putting on her lipstick in the mirror and she like smears it all over her face, and some of the updates are really clever. So the three witches are binmen who come round to gather the bins, and some of their prophecies are obviously updated for language reasons, and one of the things they say is, instead of when Birnam Wood comes to Dunsinane, it's pigs will fly. At the end, one of the climaxy moments is he hears all these helicopters, he can hear helicopters everywhere, and then he realizes they're police helicopters, and he starts manically laughing and saying pigs will fly, pigs will fly. And I just, there are so many things about it that I thought were really clever, and maybe I'm just like, maybe it was one of the first Shakespeare's I saw on TV, so maybe that's why I loved it so much, and maybe I'd watch it back and see a lot of problems with it, but I would recommend people give it a go.
It sounds pretty, I wouldn't say that sounds gimmicky, I think all
they
of that
managed
sounds,
to get around it.
It sounds quite sort of, and this is what I maybe gimmicky is the wrong word, like, I'm not against people trying things with Shakespeare. What bothers me is when they all fall into the same vein, and I just feel like I've seen like a lot of
famous actors wearing big military trench coats recently doing speeches.
Yeah, it's, I think it's because as well that courtliness is a bit difficult for us to access as yeah. modern audiences. So much of it around surrounds like court power play. But that idea of like work-based power play is something that we can relate to, and military power play is something we can relate to. And that's, I think, why, as we'll talk about later, a lot of Shakespeare's are turned into teen movies, because high school power dynamics yeah. is something that we all understand as well.
But there are other places as well. Like last year, I saw a really good revival of Richard Bean's play Toast, which mm-hmm. is set in a bread factory. And whilst it doesn't have a tragic outcome, it does have the same ambition and hierarchical structures that lend men to do terrible things to each other, you know?
Yeah.
So there are myriad scenarios that you can map it onto, but people seem to go quite safe a lot of the time.
Yeah, well, I thought this one was an absolute triumph, really. And actually, the longer I've spent away from watching it, I only watched it last night, but I feel like this morning I was more positive about it even than I was the night before.
Yeah, same. And it's also one I really want to watch again, because there were a few occasions where I was so kind of caught up in, oh my god, he's being stabbed to death, that I feel like
yeah.
I didn't.
Oh, I can see his stomach coming yeah. out of his body.
I feel like there's more things I could get from it once the initial shock was over. Talk about a season of drama adaptations that have just been on the BBC. They're all adaptations of sort of classic 20th century novels. So the four of them that they've been are Lady Chatterley's Lover, The Go-Between, and Inspector Calls and Cider with Rosie. So we thought the best way of doing this would be to, for us each to watch one, and then we'll kind of chat generally about the thing. So I've watched Lady Chatterley's Lover, and Anna, you watched...
I watched Cider with Rosie.
Cider with Rosie, that's it. So they're all kind of, I feel like, from the first half of the 20th century
yeah,
things, aren't
I
they?
I think that's what gives them their classic status yeah. in a way.
I feel like they're all things that you will have studied at least one of them at school.
Definitely. All, like, Inspector Calls is a real one for that.
Yeah, that's like a GCSE set test.
Yeah,
text,
loads of
it?
People I know study that.
So they're all things that have a kind of familiarity, and also, just to be completely cynical for a second, because the BBC put these up against Downton on Sunday nights, they all have a kind of certain like costume drama,
there's a definite period feel
aesthetic as well, which I think was a bit of a kind of, given that Downton is like the one thing the BBC just cannot trump,
yeah,
this was clearly their attempt to steal some of that viewership.
Absolutely.
Lady Chatterley's Lover that I watched was a strangely sexless version of what is supposedly the sexiest book ever.
Oh yeah, that sounds to me like a quite a big flaw.
Yeah.
My poor darling.
Constance, this is our new gamekeeper.
A lady.
I love you.
I'm very tired.
If it became known we were together, I'd lose more than my job.
Are you afraid?
First, I want to tell you about the most ridiculous thing that has ever happened to me with a book, which was, it's not a first edition, but it's a fairly early edition of Lady Chatterley's Lover, and it's a Penguin one, and it's like, you know, the orange and white
classic,
stripe
yeah.
classic thing. And I was reading that on a train once when I was a student, and, you know, the guard came round to check my ticket. He saw what I was reading. Initially, I thought he was saying this as a joke. He was like, oh, you shouldn't be reading that, it's a naughty book. And so I like laughed and was like, ah, we're all having jokes now. And then he went all like dead behind the eyes and was like, no, young women should not be reading, you know, terrible, terrible,
oh
like morally endangering stuff like that. And I was like, what? And I was sitting at a table seat, and there was a guy sitting opposite me, like a business guy, who just looked up like, what are you
what
saying?
Is happening?
But I'm not even sure if he'd heard the content of what he'd said, but just the hectoring tone made him be like, why are you talking to this woman like that?
Oh man.
And after a couple more, no one will ever want to marry you if you read things like that, is a phrase I remember specifically, the guard went away. But then every time he passed me, or for the rest of the journey, he like tutted really loudly.
Oh, so that's so funny. So the train conductor imposing rigid moral conduct upon you.
Yes.
Conductor's got to conduct.
Yeah, exactly. He wanted to conduct my reading experience.
That's so funny.
But I feel that's kind of relevant to this adaptation, in the sense that if you've actually read Lady Chatterley's Lover, you will know that far more obscene and sexually explicit things have been published since that have not been banned. It was very much a censorship like of its time and of a perceived particular kind of morality. And also because the sexiness was so bound up with class boundaries was, I think, part of the problem. Because there are much raunchier things that remained in print, but that was because they were all about aristocrats doing it or whatever.
Whereas this
was people crossing class boundaries. So it was politically subversive as well as being rude. Even if people haven't read it or whatever, it remains in the kind of culture as something naughty.
A banned book,
something that you've got to like read behind brown paper or something. Mm-hmm. Hence why the train guy behaved like that. But this adaptation seems to me to have taken a step away from both of those things, in the sense that it's not very sexy, both in the sense that its sex scenes aren't sexy and also there aren't many sex scenes in it.
Mm-hmm.
And also the kind of class element of it has just been kind of flattened out.
You'd think that if they didn't have one, they would try extra hard to, you know, nail the other.
Yeah, I was really surprised. So the whole thing about Connie Chatley is supposed to have, in the book, she's supposed to have been a kind of middle class girl who's kind of married up.
Mm-hmm.
And Mella's the gamekeeper who she has the disastrous affair with is supposed to be a gamekeeper who then, in a way that I think happened to a lot of men, he went and served in the First World War, and while he was there he got commissioned as an officer and basically rewarded for his kind of natural talent. That in a weird way the army was more of a meritocracy than actual society, so some people with talent actually got promoted beyond what their class deemed they should be. So he comes back from war and he goes back to being a gamekeeper, but he's all dissatisfied because he's actually had a taste of what it would be like if he could actually just be rewarded for his abilities. They kind of come together in their mutual dissatisfaction with their positions in the post-war society. That is what D.H. Lawrence is really writing about. It's very British, you know, this focus on like microcosm of tiny little class movements.
Yeah, and the obsession with like hierarchies and standards.
But that is where the transgressions happen. But in this adaptation, for all that it is gorgeous looking, she is posh. She marries someone posh. And the gamekeeper is like a poor man with an accent.
So they've really like smushed and flattened down those like nuances.
Yeah, so that was kind of disappointing. It wasn't titillating on any front, whether politically or otherwise.
Was there anything you did like about it?
As I say, the look of it is right. I think Holiday Granger, her name is, the actress who plays Lady Chatley, she's very beautiful and she's very kind of fresh-faced and naive looking, which is right for the part. I mean, the guy who plays Mellors, I don't recognise him, but I guess maybe he's like a famous heartthrobby man.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows? But the guy who plays Clifford Chatley, that I thought actually gave the best performance in the whole thing. My favourite bit of it was he has this motorised wheelchair that he sort of like charges round the grounds and woods in, and that is something that is in the book, that it kind of adds to this heightened sense of tension between the lovers, that not only can they be surprised by her husband, they can be surprised by her husband like going at speed through the woods.
Yeah.
So he's got, there's like a horn on it that he like honks, and she keeps thinking she hears it because the time between her hearing the horn and him like finding her is really,
very,
really
short.
It's not like hearing someone coming upon you on foot. So his disability actually gives him this like superpower of being able to creep up on her.
But perhaps not one you'd recommend overall.
No, I don't think so. Was Cider with Rosie any better?
I actually did really like it. I haven't read Cider with Rosie in a long time, so there might be some bigger Laurie Lee fans out there who disagree with me, but I think it was very true to the book.
Memories mark you.
Who we got here then?
Laurie Lee.
Remembering is to relive. We knew what was happening to us. We just didn't know what to do with it.
Hello.
What are you doing?
Oh!
Have you been giving that Rosie bird up the runaround nest?
You all right there, Rosie?
I remember when you two were little.
Ain't nothing doing.
Don't catch me!
It's the path of true love.
For people who don't know, Side with Rosie is an autobiographical take on a childhood in Gloucestershire, which is where I'm from. So as I was talking about going to Cheltenham, my hometown, earlier in the episode, Side with Rosie is set in the sort of surrounding villages. So Stroud, Painswick, Slad, these are all places very much part of my growing up. I could see that it had been filmed around there. Maybe there are some bits that weren't, but I think I could tell that most of it seemed to be filmed in and around sort of Painswick and Stroud and those kind of places. Again, like as you say, that Lady Chatterley's lover was, this was really beautiful to look at. Lots of kind of sweeping shots of the Slad Valley, and so I really enjoyed that part. And the acting I thought was very good in it, and they had a great voiceover from Timothy Spall as Laurie Lee, which often quoted verbatim chunks of the book over scenes, which I really liked. So that gave it a nice character. Also, there was a version, I think in the late 90s, so it must have been just around the time that Laurie Lee died, there was another sort of adaptation for TV of Cider with Rosie in which Laurie Lee actually did narrate it and spoke from chunks of the book. So I'm sure Timothy Spall probably heard that and tried to do it in that style, because it felt quite quite convincing. Lots of nice broad Gloucestershire accents, which again, but nice and nostalgic for me. Some of them too over the top, but some of them really nice. Like the book, it's non-chronological. The book sort of organises itself in themes around, you know, maybe first loves or school or the war. And this did that, I think, surprisingly well, although the end shots of this adaptation are some of the first pages of the novel.
Okay.
They end with the war ending in this adaptation, and Laurie Lee's book starts with the war ending, and so you always sort of feel, in a weird way, inside with Rosie, the war ending is the end of the world, and it's like quite sad, even though obviously it's a celebratory thing. It's sad for a number of reasons. It's sad because they have a sort of deserter in the woods who is dating Lol, which is the childhood nickname, Laurie Lee's sister, and so when the war ends, he's discovered, and that's very sad because he's taken away. And also they realise that their father, who's been away in London working on the war, isn't actually going to come back once the war's ended, so that's very sad for them. So there, and also it's kind of Lol's realization about, you know, being a soldier isn't this like fantastic amazing thing. Actually, lots of people lost their, obviously so many people lost their husbands and so on. So I think it did that very well, even the sort of reordering of that kind of stuff, so you're really, you know, there's a sense the whole way through that you're pushing towards this end. And so much of it is obviously to do with like childhood innocence, and they do the whole, you know, idea of having cider with Rosie really well. In the book, that's called the first bite of the apple, so we all know what that means. And that's done really well and really, really innocently and very, very sweetly in this. Like, even when the girls are very sexual, it's obviously in such a charming and youngish sort of way that it's really sweet. So yeah, overall it was just a real nostalgia experience for me, although my childhood looked nothing like that.
No.
You know, this pastoral idyll, it just didn't. But the places were familiar to me, and some of the ways of speaking obviously aren't like how people were speaking in Cheltenham when I was growing up, as you can probably tell from my accent, but it just felt very authentic in a more broad sense of the word. It felt very true to childhood experience, which is lovely. A couple of shout outs as well. BB Cave, who is Jessie Caves, who is Lavender Brown in Harry Potter, younger sister, she's very good in it. I don't know the name of the actor who plays the very young Lol, who's terribly cute. Samantha Morton as his mum is absolutely excellent. And a final shout out to Billy Howell, who is an actor who was in Channel 4's Glue recently, alongside Jessie Cave actually, and he's my dream boy, and he was in it. He was wonderful. He's just the absolute dream boy.
So, that sounds a lot more successful than my one.
I think it's worth giving a try. It reminded me a little bit of the adaptation of Tess of the D'Urbervilles that was on TV a while ago, which I really liked and had Eddie Redmayne in. And also, I, talking more about the diaries I stumbled across in my house this weekend, I found a page of my diary devoted to Angel Clare, Eddie Redmayne from like 2008. So I liked him before all of you, okay? It had that kind of like vibe to it. It was really like beautiful and like trying to be quite authentic, but in a very intentionally rosy way. Yeah, I liked it a lot. I would recommend it, I think.
Yeah, okay, I'll give that one a go. I can't recommend The Lady Chatterley, sorry.
Okay.
It's just a bit waste of your time, really.
Especially Samantha Morton as the mum. She's really, really... Like,
I'm generally pro her. I like
her. Yeah, she's great.
I know our boss, Jason, really liked The Go-Between.
Okay, so maybe we should try that.
Maybe we can secondhand give that as an endorsement as well.
Okay.
A kind of uneven set of adaptations, it sounds like, but...
Decide for yourself. Yeah. Last week, I gave Caroline She's the Man, the wonderful classic adaptation of Twelfth Night, into a high school teen movie extravaganza.
Hey!
Hey! What up?
What's your name?
Sebastian Hastings.
Duke Corsino.
This is Andrew and Toby. They live next door.
Yeah, freshman dorms that-a-way, Twiglet.
Seriously, how old are you?
I skipped a couple grades. I'm brilliant. Shh.
Caroline, thoughts?
Well, firstly, I cannot believe you made me watch a football film.
I did say, I can't believe I forgot this, but I was like, yeah, for some reason she has to be a man. I can't really remember why. Like, obviously the whole point is that she wants to get on the football team.
I really, really enjoyed it. The soccer thing was sort of a bit like, what? Why is this in it?
But must like Bend It Like Beckham.
Oh yeah, but again,
that's like just the best movie ever.
I don't think it really counts as like a football film. In the same way that this one's not really a football film, but I was surprised by the
context,
how much of the sort of climax of the film was watching
watching people do football. Yeah, I really like the update. It's part of that whole like 90s teen movie canon, isn't
yeah.
it? Where they've taken, which is very much our theme this week, as you may be able to guess, listeners, where you take something from ye olden days and put it into a new context.
But especially Shakespeare. There were so many yeah. 90s teen Shakespeares, which I also think really ties into the fact that the 90s was just an amazing period for teen movies, full yeah. stop. It was just like a great renaissance of like the John Hughes style. Like there were so many great teen movies.
Yeah, so like 10 Things I Hate About You is
Taming of the Shrew.
And I mean, it's not Shakespeare, but Clueless is Emma by yeah. Jane Austen.
There's also an Othello called O that was, I think, actually not great. But there are a few, like, it's yeah. crazy.
And so I knew that this was based on Twelfth Night, and obviously the kind of main feature of Twelfth Night is the twins and the kind of gender disguise.
Yeah, which they've altered a bit, haven't they? Because in Twelfth Night, Olivia is not dressing as Sebastian. She's got a different pseudonym.
Viola.
Hasn't
Viola.
Sorry.
Yeah, yeah. yeah. They're both pretending to be like a third person called Cesario.
Did you notice the restaurant they go to is called Cesario?
Yes.
In the same so way, random.
I love those touches in these things. In the same way that like the boys' boarding school she goes to in order
it's
to...
It's called Illyria.
It's called Illyria.
Yeah.
Which is obviously the like... fictional place there,
but that kind of works in a way because they do have this sort of like Latinate names, don't they,
yeah.
in some like elite part, you know, schools in America, so kind of
and
makes
like,
sense.
I liked how Channing Tatum plays Duke Orsino, where Duke is just his first name because it's American.
Yeah,
Duke
you can
be
do
a first
that.
Name there. So yeah, I did really like it. It had all of the kind of hallmarks of a great teen movie. You know, it had the primary couple and then the secondary couple. It even had the bad aspects of a teen movie, so it had like the token black person, so it had just had all of those really familiar tropes,
yeah.
But with the added element of like squashing them into a kind of Shakespeare retelling.
Yeah, and those comedies, we were just saying off the podcast, because like the podcast is our lives, but those movies are so great in terms of like the Shakespeare translates really well into a teen movie, because there's so much like mistaken identity and like physical comedy and elaborate misunderstandings that kind of go quite well into that setting.
Yeah, and also there's always this sense in, particularly in Shakespeare comedies, that you need these undercurrents of power and momentum that you don't really have to explain but need to be there for the sakes of the plot.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise it doesn't work. So mm-hmm. Much Ado About Nothing, you just have to accept the fact that Claudio and Hero are going to have to be apart for a while, for whatever, even if it seems improbable, because otherwise the story doesn't work.
Yeah.
Because their resolution ties up lots of other things.
Yeah.
And I feel in the high school context, because of just the like routine and the schedule and the pressures of having to go to lessons and football games being at a certain time and all this kind of stuff, that gives you that forward momentum that you struggle to recreate, I think, in a kind of grown-up adaptation.
Exactly. I think what it highlights essentially, as anyone who's been to like secondary school or high school can testify, is that it's a farce. Like the whole concept of high school and like the way it's run is so bizarre that actually it works really well to take these completely unbelievable farcical storylines and put them into it. Also, there's often a sense that like young people will be like pranking each other,
yeah.
and doing things like that that would be quite difficult to get across or like believe in an adult setting. So it just works really well. And She's the Man, I think there are several points that like play well with that.
Yeah, and also just I felt the way that you had to like slightly suspend your disbelief that,
well, a lot actually,
yeah, that anyone believes that Amanda Bynes like in a short wig could pass as a boy.
And that's the great reveal where she takes off her like tiny fake sideburns, which they've obviously done like quite small so as to not make her look too masculine, because then who would come see the movie, am I
yeah.
right? Like, and she takes them off and everyone's like and it's like so so ridiculous.
It reminds me actually of a great radio sketch from the writer of Cabin Pressure, John Finnemore, which is set in like a World War II like research bunker, and Churchill comes to visit and he gets introduced to the lady boffins and he's very like, you have lady boffins, and then he gets quite friendly with one of the lady boffins and then her manager comes over and is like, lady boffin, put your glasses back on, and she puts her glasses on and Churchill's like, what is that? The whole point being that
yeah.
you know, the absurdity of like a woman put her glasses on, now she's not sexy,
like, and She's All That, Lainey Bob. All she has is a pair of glasses, and between her being beautiful and being ugly.
Yeah, exactly. So this is like, she took the side buttons on, it's like, oh wow, she's so
yeah.
hot. It was just really, really joyful.
Very silly. I think there are some problems with it. So obviously this film, looking back, there are some real like worrying bits. So it's very heteronormative. Like, a lot of the jokes depend on the fact that, like, if it was discovered that Amanda Bynes was really a man, then, like, what was going on would be... No, sorry, Amanda Bynes was really a woman. That it, like, the humour disappears because, like, a lot of the jokes are like, hey, dude, what are you doing? You're being, like, over-familiar. So those jokes are a little bit homophobic. And obviously also there's the really cisgendered, like, I'm going to show my penis to prove I'm a man. I'm going to show my tits to show that I'm a girl. And it's like the idea that someone's body would not match up to their either assigned or personal gender is, like, so horrifying and, like, against the rules. And dreadful.
Yeah, it does feel very of its time in that sense.
Yeah, it is dated.
It has dated in that aspect, but I think in the more general, like, teen themes of kind of angst and dating and that kind of stuff, it stands up.
Yeah, we have to give it a bit of credit in that. So Channing Tatum as Duke, a lot of the joke is that he's, like, not that masculine, although he looks that masculine, very masculine. Yeah. And, like, he's treated often as the typical high school boy, and actually he, like, cares about people's feelings and blah blah blah. And that's often done quite well and not in a, like, haha, let's all laugh at him way. Channing Tatum, by the way, I think is so brilliant in it.
Yeah, I love how even... Because is this pre-Step Up? It must be.
It's 2006, Step Up.
Maybe Step Up had already happened. But I love how there is just a point, I think it's during a football game, where he just does, like, a pointless backflip. Yeah. It's like, at no point has it been suggested why his character would do backflips, but he just... It's almost like he can't restrain himself. He has to do something really athletic.
He looks, like, 20 years older than everyone else in it. There's, like, a point in it where Olivia is saying, like, oh my God, so glad I finally found a real man. And she's, like, draping herself all over him, trying to make Sebastian, who's Amanda Bynes in the wig, jealous. And you're like, yeah, it is hilarious that you found a real man at this school, because Channing Tatum's clearly about 27 and why is he at school?
Yeah.
But also he's so great at, like, physical comedy. Like, there's this great moment where he's, like, on the phone and he's trying to pretend that the phone call is something that it's not, or, like, he's trying to hang up the phone, like, when he's in the gym and he, like, fumbles with the phone and, like, hits his head on the weightlifting thing, and it's like, but he's just so good at it. You're like, oh, I, like, love you. You're so funny. And, like, anyway, fangirl over.
I was so excited that there was a film of that type that I hadn't seen.
Yeah.
It was so lovely to watch, because I've watched Clueless, like, a million times.
Yeah.
It was so lovely to, like, actually experience one of those for the first time again.
Good.
And actually, there was one point where the song is by Air. It's called Sexy Boy.
Oh, yeah, I love Air. That's one of my favourite albums.
So that song is in both 10 Things I Hate About You and She's the Man. And I was like, yes, it is all a canon.
There's also that song that goes like, I'll make you my dirty little secret. Yes. Yeah. That's it. And I was really, like, transported back. It's really fun. Well, were there any, like, main highlights for you? Any jokes or bits that you really loved?
I really loved the, like, cat fight in the toilet.
Yeah, that's really good. I was watching that and I was like, God, they have such mean girls heels. Like, such early noughties heels on.
Yeah.
American as well. I don't think anyone in the UK was wearing those shoes. No. And then she comes in, doesn't she? The one who's, like, leading the ball preparations. And she's like, when debutantes disagree, they say it with their eyes.
Yeah, so I found that really funny.
Yeah.
I also really liked the montage of Amanda Bynes / Sebastian is getting really good at football, and how she's, like, doing chest bumps with people and then being like, ow! And then, like, doing some dancing. Also, Vinnie Jones.
I know, that's so
as
funny.
Their football coach.
Vinnie Jones is the football coach. And he's just like, all right, guys, let's play some bloody football.
Yeah.
Like, why are you here? This is so weird, but great.
So that was also, I really enjoyed that.
One of my absolute highlights of this film, there's sort of a kind of, not even subplot, but a vague suggestion that she's adapting a lot more masculine mannerisms as the film goes on, when she's like even dressing as herself and, like, being a woman. And there's a bit where she's, like, at one of the debutante ball rehearsal things and she's, like, eating a chicken leg, like, really, really, like, disgustingly. And then this woman is like, Viola, remember, chew as if you have a secret. And she's like, instead of, like, chewing politely, she, like, carries on chewing the way she is, but she does, like, suspicious eyes. She's, like, looking around the room, like, and it honestly makes me laugh so much. Watching that, I was like, the way that you think you should behave when you have a secret really, like, shows up all your why you've made so many mistakes so far in this film. Like, you don't seem to understand that, like, doing suspicious eyes does not make you look less suspicious. For all its flaws, I really love it. I think it's, like, a really joyful film.
I had the same feelings about it as I have about 10 Things I Hate About You, which is that film is problematic.
In so many ways.
In so many ways, looking back at it now. That said, you know, if I'm ill or if it's raining or whatever, I will always put a film like that on just because it will always make me feel happy. And She's the Man definitely falls into that. So for next week, we're going to do something totally different. I'm going to recommend you a book which is from, like, the first half of the 20th century. It's by Sylvia Townsend Warner. It's called Lolly Willows.
I know her name. What would I have known else by her? I'm sure I've read.
She was generally a kind of journalist and writer, sort of like early suffragette type person.
Yeah. Did she write for the New Statesman ever?
I think she may have done, actually.
I think that's maybe why I know her name.
Yeah, she was definitely around at that time. Geekula, I first knew of her as she was one of the editors of the first Oxford Tudor music anthology. Oh. So, yeah, you know, obviously a big figure in my education. Yeah, so Lolly Willows is a little book, and it's just the story of a woman called Lolly Willows and about her growing up in the country and the kind of rooted ruralness of her life. And then everything changes when her father dies and she has to move to London to live with her brother. And then after, you know, decades of life as a kind of poor relation in this family, she's just actually, you know what, screw it, I'm moving back to the country and I'm going to do what I want. That's all it's about. But there's just a real like vibe about it that I think you're going
to
like.
Oh, I'm really excited to read it. Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to Seriously, the pop culture podcast from the New Statesman. All the details about how to get in touch with us are on newstatesman.com/SRSLY.
If you've been listening to the podcast for a while and you've enjoyed it, we'd really love it if you could leave us a review on iTunes. Then it's much easier for new people to find us. Thanks so much.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.